Welcome to 2819. I'm Sandra Dimas.
And I'm Brian Rombacher.
And we have a fun show for you today. Lots of deep topics, yeah?
That's right. In RTB 101, we'll be hearing from physicist Erica Carlson on quantum mechanics and logic.
And in Give and Take, Jeff Zoering will be interviewing biochemist Fuzzel Rana on if viruses point to a designer.
First up is Culture Talk. Sandra and theologian Ken Samples will be talking about the philosophy of existentialism. Let's check it out.
Now it's time for Culture Talk, where we talk about culturally relevant topics that you can use to start conversations about your faith. And I'm joined today with philosopher and theologian Kenneth Samples. Thank you, Ken, for joining us.
Hi, Sandra.
We're going to be talking about a very lighthearted topic, existentialism. Actually, you wrote a blog recently about existentialism. And I feel like that is such an important topic to kind of unpack. First, let's talk about what does that mean? What does that school of thought mean?
Yeah, right at the heart of that word is the word exist or existence. And so I would define existentialism as a philosophy that focuses on human existence, particularly for individuals. You know, who am I? Why am I here? Where am I going? And it would also recognize that truth isn't always just intellectual and cerebral. There are truths in art, there's truths in various other fields. And so existentialism focuses upon the importance of human existence.
So when we think about existentialists, who would be some key proponents of that school of thought?
Yeah, well, one of the most important would be the Christian philosopher Soren Kierkegaard. He's often called the father of the movement. An atheist philosopher, Friedrich Nietzsche, was a very important forerunner of the movement. All the way into the 20th century, that's where existentialism really explodes. So Jean-Paul Sartre, the French philosopher, would be an atheist. There are many theists, both Christian and Jewish, who would see themselves as part of the movement.
So how would we differentiate between a Christian existentialist and an atheist existentialist?
Yeah, they share things important in common. I mean, they're searching, they raise the question, why do I struggle to find meaning in my life, or why do I experience angst? So those are similar things. But Christians would say, you know, you have the argument from desire. You're yearning and you're desiring something more in this world that you're not having. I think atheists raise those very same questions. You know, how do I find meaning? And so I think a very important definition is the atheist would say, when you're born into the world, you exist. And then you have to go searching for your essence. Christians, on the other hand, would say, when you're born into the world, you have an essence. You're made in the image of God. So that question of existence and essence is important.
So if, from a Christian perspective, these thinkers would say that we exist because we're made in God's image, then where would be kind of the struggle, or what would make that person a Christian existentialist as opposed to a Christian?
I think an important component in the Christian side is our fallenness. So we're made in the image of God, but that image has been tarnished. Original sin has kind of warped us where we are disordered. So, you know, we may look at good things like food, but we may eat too much of it. We look at good things like sex, but we misuse it. Money is a good thing, but maybe we want to acquire more than other people have. So from a Christian point of view, our angst comes out of that fallen nature. For the atheists, they would just simply say, you know, we're born into this world that has no ultimate meaning. We have to go out and create it and kind of create our own essence, our own importance and being.
So from the Christian perspective, if there's an emphasis on our fallen nature, is it sort of more of a perspective that is melancholy, like that sort of worldview?
Yeah, definitely. And if you think about a historical context, I mean, right after World War II, I mean, Europe is in rubble. The world is pessimistic. It's gone through two world wars. There's a lot of questions, like maybe we're not, you know, maybe we shouldn't put so much hope in science and technology. Maybe human beings aren't quite what we thought they were. So there's kind of a pessimism that runs through it. But I think I think what's cool about it, from my point of view, is that here you have atheists and Christians who are talking to each other mm-hmm. because they're sharing a similar philosophical movement.
Yeah. I do like that, like finding common ground
yeah.
with people from different perspectives. I think what you brought up as far as the time period of like World War II yeah. and this pessimistic view kind of is in line with what we're experiencing. Many of us are experiencing now yeah. that we're in this place of kind of deep reflection, some melancholy, yeah. some angst. So how would you engage a conversation with someone who is leaning toward an existential perspective to share some hope with them?
Yeah, I think that that's a really important component. I think what I would share, Sandra, is that, you know, where do we get our meaning? Mm-hmm. If God exists, and if we're made in His image, and if Jesus is the divine human person, He comes into the world to redeem us. Mm-hmm. If Christianity is true, there's just enormous hope, meaning, hope, and purpose. If there is no God, do we have the requisite ability to go out and create meaning in a meaningless world? Mm-hmm. I think the atheist has a real struggle with trying to find meaning mm-hmm. if there's no God. So I think that discussion of where do you derive your meaning, where is your significance, yeah. and where do you anchor it?
Yeah, I think that's helpful for those who are focusing more on the fallen nature of humanity. What would you point to as far as the beauty of humanity?
Yeah, I think that's wonderful because Blaise Pascal, one of my favorite mm-hmm. philosophers, who I think had kind of an existential temperament as well, mm-hmm. he said human beings are an enigma of greatness and wretchedness. Mm-hmm. The greatness, the imago Dei, we are exceptional creatures, as Fuzzarana would say. And yet, human beings have a brokenness, they have a fallenness. None of us can stop sinning, none of us can break away totally from our narcissism. Mm-hmm. I think the Christian mm-hmm. message really pegs the person in the mirror. Greatness and wretchedness.
Yeah. And I think that's helpful for people because when we think of what it means to be a Christian and we know that we're engaging with people who are demonstrating their fallen side, it yeah. can sometimes create a rift between a person who is curious about faith and God versus the people. Like sometimes yeah. people and their fallenness can get in between us and God, unfortunately.
Yeah. You know, I jokingly say, if you don't believe in original sin, read some of the anonymous comments on the web.
Oh, my God.
And, you know, but I still think that here you have a philosophy, mm-hmm. an interesting philosophy that draws secular and religious people, not just mm-hmm. Christians, but also Jews.
Right. Well, thank you for that. So sure. if people want to learn more about this topic, where would you point them to?
Well, I have an article. My blog page is Reflections by Ken at WordPress.com. If you go on there and look at St. Augustine and the philosophy of existentialism.
Wonderful. Thank you so much for that, Ken. So if you want to hear more from Ken, visit his blog. You can also find it on reasons.org and search for Reflections.
One of the areas of quantum mechanics that I find fascinating is how quantum mechanics relates to reason, logic, and rationality. And to unpackage this question, we've invited Dr. Erica Carlson to speak with us. Erica, I gave a talk one time about the laws of logic, particularly the law of non-contradiction. Aristotle said nothing can both be and not be at the same time and in the same way. A cannot equal A and non-A. I had a physicist in the audience, and he said, wait a second here. What about quantum mechanics? I mean, couldn't light appear as a wave and a particle at the same time? What does quantum mechanics do to maybe some of these principles of logic and reasoning? Are we misunderstanding something there?
That's a great question. So when you first started talking about, you know, the law of non-contradiction and how it might play into quantum mechanics, having, you know, being a physicist who's well-trained in quantum mechanics and, you know, teaches it to others, and, you know, I'm familiar with all the equations, you know, math can't be self-contradictory, right? So
right, right.
So in our mind, the grounding of it is all this beautiful mathematics, which if we had a couple of years together, we could I could teach you too. It's not impenetrable. It just takes some time and effort. But mathematics, you know, cannot be self-contradictory, right? It is in the deductive epistemology, right? You start with certain axioms and then you derive things out of that. So all of our mathematics is completely self-consistent. There's no room for contradiction. Now, perhaps one of the ways that it's coming up, like you said, is in the interpretation of it. Mm. What does it mean?
Okay.
You know? And typically, we are very used to, as scientists, our mathematics having a one-to-one correspondence with the things we measure in ways that we can dig in and test every single piece of that. So we are used to being able to test every bit. And it's really kind of fun. You know, a big part of what I do as a professor is teach courses. It's not the biggest part. Most of what I do is do science. I'm a scientist, but I do get to teach a few courses. And so one of the things that that's kind of fun to watch students discover and learn is that all that math they're writing down on the page really does have a physical correspondence. Now, in quantum mechanics, it's much harder to figure out because we write down mathematics that also involves probabilities. And there's the crux, okay? We are writing down things that work, okay, where the mathematical thing is self-contained, well-defined, no logical contradictions. We can't test every piece of it. This, I think, is part of the frustration of quantum mechanics. In classical mechanics, I could test every single piece of that equation and find an experimental counterpart. In quantum mechanics, you really need to work in terms of a wave function, oftentimes. Not always, but oftentimes it's going to come to the forefront that these tiny particles don't just act like little solid balls, because they're not. They act like very fuzzy objects, and they have wave properties. They can interfere and wiggle and take on interesting shapes just like waves do. And so there's the rub. We cannot directly measure the waves in quantum mechanics. It's just a limitation of our experiments. People sometimes ask me, are we ever going to get past that limitation? We haven't gotten past it in 100 years, so I'm going to throw my hat in and say, no, I think we're stuck there. But, you know, if someone figures out how to measure it, that's great. That'd be fantastic. So there are pieces in our self-contained, fully logical, no contradictions mathematics that we cannot directly access in the lab, namely the wave function. So that means we don't actually know if the wave function is real.
Mm.
Okay? We see all the evidence that the outputs of the theory, the things that we go in the lab and test, happen according to the probabilistic evolution of this wave function. They happen that way. So now you're going to find a divide among scientists who work on this. You know, some people say, oh, the wave function behaves in such a physical manner. I'm one of these people. I think it behaves in such a beautiful physical manner. It must be real. There must be some truth to it. And then you're going to find other people who say, well, we're really just using it as an instrument of mathematics. We can't directly test whether this piece of the mathematics corresponds to reality. And so some people say, it's just a calculation device. That's, you'll find if you start reading about quantum mechanics or especially philosophy of quantum mechanics, you'll see this lovely phrase called shut up and calculate, which is basically, to say that it doesn't matter that we can't directly test whether this piece is real. We can still use it, and we do. And this is one of the beauties of physics, is that we don't have to know everything in order to make progress. So there are absolutely pieces in there that are untested. However, the outputs work so precisely that if any theory comes along to replace this one, it's got to have all the same outputs. So there is absolutely, there are absolutely elements of truth in there. We just can't test all the working parts.
Now, as a physicist, you're looking at the world, in my thinking at least, through the prism of mathematics.
Right.
What is that? What is math and logic and reason? How does that connect with your faith? You're not just a physicist, you're also a Christian.
Okay, so the very fact that I can apply mathematics and reason to the natural world, to me, speaks of a creator. When you were saying that we kind of look at things through the lens of mathematics, I am a theoretical physicist. And so, physics has this division of labor that's come about as the field has gotten more complicated and more advanced. We found that typically most people choose either to be theorists, that's me, or experimentalists. Theorists do math about the way the world should be. Experimentalists test the way the world actually is. Or sometimes people are observationalists, like astronomers don't get to run controlled experiments on galaxies. They just observe what actually has happened. So I'm a theorist. I am quite big on the math. At the same time, we all agree that there's some mathematical there's some logic that we use the language of mathematics to describe that logic, and that is ultimately controlling things. When we write down a law of physics, we are using the language of mathematics. Now, the very fact that I can write down laws that make sense to my human brain is totally amazing. And to me, that's evidence that somebody, whoever designed these things, wants us to figure them out, right? We could conceive of writing down laws of physics that are so complicated you would never be able to figure them out by the scientific method. You just need to throw in enough variables that are operating at the same length scales and energy scales, and it would become this Gordian knot that you couldn't untie. So I think the very fact that these knots of logic are loosely tied and we can go in and tease them out is evidence that someone wanted us to solve that puzzle. And I think that in and of itself is evidence of a creator.
Hello, Jeff Zwerink here. Welcome back to Give and Take, the segment of our show where we explore important scientific ideas and see how they relate to the truth of Christianity. Today, I'm joined by my friend and colleague, Dr. Fuz Rana, and we're going to discuss SARS-CoV-2 and how it might point towards a creator. Fuz, good to have you here today.
Jeff, thanks for having me.
So I know you've had this discovery you found that kind of piqued your interest in thinking about this. What's the discovery? Give us a little bit of background for it.
Yeah, well, you know, when it comes to the SARS coronavirus 2 and COVID-19, there's a lot of things that are really unusual about COVID-19 as a disease, but also about the biology and the replication cycle of the SARS coronavirus 2. And for example, one of the things that's unusual about COVID-19 is that patients that recover from COVID-19 will actually test positive in PCR tests for the COVID-19 virus or the SARS coronavirus 2.
So that's a test as though they have the virus even though they've recovered from the virus.
Right, and the PCR test is detecting viral genetic material in the patient. So even though they don't have any symptoms, even though they're not infectious, they still are testing as if the viral genetic material is present. And so a team from MIT tried to figure out what was going on there. And bottom line is they discovered something unexpected, namely that it looks as if parts of the genetic material from the SARS coronavirus 2 actually will incorporate into the genome of host cells. And then once incorporated, those DNA sequences will begin to express RNA that produces viral products that's picked up by the immune system. And so it's why they are testing positive for the PCR test.
That's just a fascinating discussion, especially since surrounding all this, there's this discussion of whether the vaccines change the genome or not. And to find out the virus itself may be doing that is really, that's kind of bizarre and ironic in one sense. But we'll leave that conversation to the side. But this has, I've read your article, and this has something to do with, or a connection at least to what are called endogenous retroviruses, which are a strong line of support for evolution. So kind of give us a little bit of background on what endogenous retroviruses are, and then I'm going to follow up and ask, how does that play into support for evolution?
So, I mean, at RTB, our position is that human beings are the handiwork of a creator. And one of the arguments against the idea that we're the product of a creator's handiwork and in favor of the fact that we have an evolutionary history is the presence of what's called junk DNA in our genome. And one category of junk DNA are called endogenous retroviruses. And about 8% of our genome is made up of, again, these endogenous retroviruses. Now, where this becomes potentially problematic is that many of the endogenous retrovirus sequences in the human genome are found in the genomes of the great apes, where the sequences are nearly similar and the location in the genomes is similar, it corresponds. And so people argue, well, this is reflecting our evolutionary history, where these endogenous retroviruses arose in the common ancestor of humans and the great apes, and were retained as the different evolutionary lineages diverged. And so they argue that these are molecular fossils that really describe our evolutionary history.
So presumably we're talking about something where there's a viral infection that gets incorporated into the DNA, and that, you know, presumably happened in some ancestor that now gets panned out matched. I mean, you know, so is it common for viral material to be injected in that? In some sense, that doesn't seem like a big deal. Is there anything more to that that makes it look like there's a history to it?
Yeah, well, you know, it is common for some viruses to incorporate their DNA into the host genome. Mm-hmm. For coronaviruses, that's really an unexpected mm-hmm. finding. But for retroviruses, that's part of their replication cycle and their biology, is they will incorporate their genetic material into the host genome. And if that happens in gametes or the sex cells, it can be propagated to the next generation. And so the argument is that this, again, is evidence for our evolutionary history. Now, what's being assumed there, however, is the idea that these endogenous retroviruses are non-functional, mm-hmm. that we think we know how they may have arisen in the human genome, and if they're non-functional, then that makes a very powerful and compelling case for human evolution.
Well, and is it not true there's even, do you often find like mutations in them as well? So they're similar mutations in not only the human, but in the chimp. And
So
it looks like, kind of the bottom line, it seems like this is fairly powerful evidence for a common descent, if you will.
It is. And in fact, I know people that say this is the evidence, mm-hmm. piece of evidence that really convinced them that humans must have evolved. But again, the assumption is, you know, these sequences are non-functional.
Okay, so let's bring in this discussion about the SARS-CoV-2 virus. What about this discovery impacts this discussion?
Yeah, well, I mean, what people believe is going on is that once the genetic material from the SARS-CoV-2 is incorporated into the host genome, it is expressed, which means it produces RNA, and that RNA is producing viral products. And people believe that this is actually a type of DNA vaccine where these viral products are being, the immune system is being exposed to these viral products on an ongoing basis. And this is actually triggering an ongoing immune response. So that is, it's part of the acquired immunity that people develop after being infected with SARS-CoV-2. And people believe that this may be a general mechanism, actually, that is more widespread with RNA viruses that are in the same type of category as the coronavirus.
So is this something that the method of propagation of the corona or these RNA viruses insert themselves into the DNA, or is this something about the human DNA that almost allows that to happen, or is that too simplistic of a question?
Well, I mean, it's essentially, you have to have the right enzymes present.
Okay.
And so retroviruses have an enzyme called reverse transcriptase that mediates the incorporation of its genetic material into the host mm-hmm. genome. Coronaviruses don't have that enzyme associated with them. So the team from MIT believes that there are these endogenous retroviral sequences in the human genome that may actually be activated as a result of the viral infection, which leads to their incorporation, into the genome. So I
just find that kind of ironic that the virus is generating something within the cell that actually contributes to the cell being able to defend against it. I find that interesting. So let's explore a little bit. How does this deal with whether we're common descent or not?
Well, if you're going to make the argument that the human genome is the product of a creator's handiwork, first and foremost, you have to have function for junk DNA, function mm-hmm. in this case for endogenous retroviruses. You have to explain why those sequences are shared with humans and the great apes. And you also have to explain why those sequences look like retroviral sequences. And there are some clues in this work on the SARS-CoV-2 that help us towards that end, mm-hmm. where you could argue that these endogenous retroviruses in our genome actually may be functioning like a DNA vaccine. And in fact, we've observed that when viral infections take place in cells, endogenous retroviruses are expressed, which means that they very well could be producing kind of an immune response or triggering an immune response that is helping the body to respond to that viral infection rather quickly. And we know that when you express endogenous retroviral DNA, it actually triggers what's known as the interferon response, which is part of our innate immunity. So this explains the fact that these endogenous retrovirus sequences may be functional. It explains why they would look like viral DNA. And it also explains why you would see those sequences not only in humans, but in the great apes, because this would be shared design as opposed to evidence for shared evolutionary ancestry.
Well, thanks, Fuzz. I really appreciate your comments. You know, when we look out in the record, especially as we're learning about the genome, we find evidence of things that people use to point towards the idea that we're all come from a common ancestor, that we are a product of common descent. But what's interesting is as we dig in, it almost looks like these evidences, particularly about endogenous retroviruses, they may actually find a more comfortable and a better home in a picture where we're the product of common design. You know, I'd encourage you to go to reasons.org, check out Fuzz's latest blog on this. It's called SARS-CoV-2 Biology Points Towards Endogenous Retrovirus Design. It'll give you some great insight, a lot of depth in how this all works, and tools that you can use to go out and show how even this latest disease points to the fact that there's a creator that created all of us.
That does it for us this week on 2819. We hope you enjoyed this episode and that it helped equip you to share your faith with confidence and compassion.
And don't forget, subscribe to the show and also find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. We are at 2819 Show. We'd love to hear your thoughts.
Also, if you're watching us on TV or on YouTube, you can get the audio version. We're on most major podcast services. Just search Reasons to Believe Podcast.
See you next week.
Bye.